Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcaster.
Welcome back to Small Caps. My name's Kerry Stevenson. Today, I'm delighted to be bringing you John Phillips. He's the Managing Director of Blue Energy, ASX code BLU. John Phillips, welcome to the program. Great to see you. Now, we're talking all things gas today. One of the things that I want to talk to you about is gas supply to the east coast of Australia, why that's important. And I think it's really important for our listeners to understand a little bit more, I guess, about the macro picture, the supply demand for gas on the east coast. So let's start with that. Why is it important to have gas supply here on the east coast of Australia? And what have been the issues in the past?
Well, thanks, Kerry. It's lovely to be here. The issue of gas on the east coast really is about supply and continued supply into the market where it's used for heating, cooking, and electricity generation. Most of the houses in Victoria are connected into reticulated gas from the Bass Strait, have been for 50 years. Bass Strait is on decline because it's been in production for so long, but effectively there isn't a ready replacement without shipping it from a long way north. The history of gas exploration and development in the East Coast has been the Cooper Basin, Bass Strait, and then a little bit out of the Surat Basin on the conventional side in the early 1670s and on through the 80s. What was the big game changer was the understanding and the development of the coal seam gas fields in the Surat Basin and Bowen Basin in the early 2000s. And that brought with it development into the domestic market, but the size of the prize was so big that it attracted the large international companies who understood that you could refrigerate gas and ship it internationally, and that's why you have an LNG business in Glasson, because the reason you cool it down is to shrink the volume to 1/600th of its gaseous volume, make it a liquid, stick it in a ship, and you can transport it over long distances. So the big players with the big balance sheets were happy to invest in acquiring the reserves and then taking the risk of a large capital risk on developing those reserves and bringing it into the international market through LNG. Now, on the East Coast, we also have manufacturers who produce glass, bricks, paper, cardboard, and also plastics. And that's another use of gas which people don't tend to appreciate all that well. It's gas and oil, for that matter, used to manufacture pharmaceuticals and medicines. As I mentioned, glass, bricks, and paper, but also fertilizer. And the big fertilizer industry is used to actually, obviously, grow food and feed the population, which is not going backwards. So the need for more gas has been exacerbated by the fact that the tripling of the gas supply on the East Coast has been driven by the export facilities built by large multinationals in Curtis Island. And to that extent, that volume of gas has been marketed on the international market. And prior to this latest hiccup, the demand for gas internationally has been quite strong. And so the price has been quite strong, and it's linked to an oil price through various formulas. And what's happened, I think, the local domestic gas users have been left out from the contracting side of things to be able to lock in long-term gas contracts with producers to underpin their manufacturing going forward.
And I think John, if I could just interrupt you for a moment, how much of our gas reserves are being exported or are owned by foreigners? And that's the first part. And secondly, has that driven up domestic gas prices here in Australia? Because I know that this is the supply of gas and electricity is a sore point, you know, prices going up. And right now we're living in pretty tough times at the moment. So first question, how much is being owned and exported by foreigners? And secondly, would that drive the price down with what you're saying?
And the simple answer is it's a complex situation. But about 80% of the 2P, so proven probable gas reserves on the East Coast, so that's from about Central Australia to the East, are owned by foreign multinationals who have either facilities in Gladstone to export LNG, and that's what some of that 2P is used for, or they've been long-term, like ExxonMobil down in Bass Strait, been supplying into the domestic market. But I think the issue has been there was an overbuild of LNG capacity in Gladstone, or in Curtis Island, in the early part of the 2010s, which has driven demand up. It was almost 3-to-1 export to domestic use. So the East Coast is about 2,000 petajoules per annum is consumed. Around about 1,400 petajoules of that goes in export LNG, and the rest 500-600 petajoules is domestic use. So I think it's fair to say that the tripling of demand on the East Coast has been met by the LNG business,
right,
which has an exposure to an LNG price, which is international, which is linked to an oil price. So when the oil price goes up, the price of the gas goes up, and that filters back into what the ACCC term as the LNG netback in Wallumbilla. Now, if you were to have gone long in your contracting strategy as a domestic gas user 10 years ago and said, I'll sign a 20-year contract at $4.50, you'd be sitting pretty right now.
Yeah.
But a lot of companies did not do that, and for their own reasons. And now they're suffering from either the high price or the lack of flow on for the low price, because effectively the LNG plants in Gladstone have the ability to sell into the domestic market when it suits them, or sell into the international market to meet their contracts. So they have some discretion in terms of cargoes that they can divert, and that's part of the ADGSM the Prime Minister's put in place and has been used to divert gas out of Gladstone into the domestic market.
Well, let's talk about that, because the Prime Minister has recently, as last week, was saying he's identified Galilee, Bowen and Beetaloo Basins as, I guess, sources for new gas supply for the East Coast market. Was that a welcome announcement for you? Has that changed in any way the Blue Energy strategy going forward?
Absolutely. I think the recognition at the highest levels of government that there are gas supply sources, new gas supply sources in sedimentary basins on the East Coast, has lifted the profile, and also it ticks the boxes in terms of Rod Sims' statements going back 3, 4, 5 years that more gas supply is needed into the market, as well as transportation mechanisms that are reasonably priced. The identification of North Bowen Basin, which is a producing basin, has been for 15 years, as a significant gas source with scale, is welcome for us, because that's the large part of our portfolio and a value in our company. So obviously I'm delighted to see the profile being lifted by none other than the Prime Minister. So there's that. There's the Galilee Basin, which is close to the North Bowen Basin, which has gas potential, again, coal seam gas. And then there's the Beetaloo Basin, which is a shale play in Northern Territory, which rivals, in terms of technical source rock capacity, with some of the North American shale basins. It's just a cost base and cost structure and remoteness issue that means that the Beetaloo is not quite at the same maturity level as, say, a North Bowen Basin.
Now, you mentioned the North Bowen Basin. It's already gas is being exported from that area. But Blue Energy, let's talk about your particular asset. Is that your main focus, is the Bowen Basin for you at the moment? And if so, why hasn't there been more development? Why did it take the Prime Minister to come out and make this statement? Why hasn't it been developed more before now?
It is our main mature asset. We've got about 3,000 petajoules of gas that's been certified as a resource and also a reserve by independent certifiers out of Dallas. We use them exclusively, and they bring to the small end of town a level of credibility that is acknowledged by ASX and ASIC. So we're happy to use independent third-party certifiers. The reason that it's been effectively dormant in the North Bowen for some time is that it has been connected to the Townsville market, which is a small market served by one of the existing operators in the North Bowen. So there hasn't been great demand to bring more gas on. With the establishment with more appraisal that's been done by ourselves and the other operator in the basin, it has established a 15,000 petajoule resource, which cannot be utilised in Townsville, and it needs a broader market, a bigger market, to underpin the development. And once we have our cost base, we've got our cost base under control, once the cost base is understood and lowered, it becomes very competitive to move that gas into the system by way of a new build pipeline infrastructure of the right size to take that volume into the East Coast market.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that infrastructure side of things. You've got the asset. And you mentioned it goes into Townsville. That's not a big market, but you need to develop the infrastructure to bring it to a bigger market on the East Coast. What does that mean for Blue Energy? What do you need to be doing? And what's the time frame? Because I know that you've been with Blue Energy now for some 10 years. What can investors start to get interested, excited about at the moment? Why is this a bit of a game changer for Blue Energy?
Well, time flies when you're having fun, and that 10 years has gone in a blink of an eye. But effectively, having the conundrum we faced was having a gas resource in that part of the basin has not been enough to entice gas buyers to come and sign up with us, because there's no infrastructure to bring the gas to them. Yeah. To bring it to market. So now that the Prime Minister and the National COVID Commission has identified the North Bowen as new supply with potential and scale, it means that there is a lot more interest now in people wanting to put infrastructure in there and aggregating the gas in the basin to deliver it into the market, and also aggregating the gas demand from buyers to say, we need X petajoules of gas over 3, 5, and 10 years. This is what we can now aim for to supply. So it actually provides the link. If there's government tacit approval and approval of the process of getting more gas into the market and identifying that basin as a near-term option to satisfy the market, then that's all good for us.
John,
time frame wise, I'd say you're looking at 3 years.
Okay, so there's yeah. been a lot of work to be done in between.
For
those listeners that don't really know where the Bowen Basin is, excuse me, is it closer to infrastructure? Just paint the picture for us as to some of the challenges and the opportunities.
So the Bowen Basin is the heart of the export coal business in Queensland, central Queensland. So it sits inboard from Mackay, but runs from Collinsville, south of Townsville, down to Blackwater and Mowra. And effectively, it is the Bowen Basin is centred around Moranbah, which is around about 450 kilometres from Gladstone. So that is the size of the length of the pipeline that would be required to be built to connect the gas resource in Moranbah or in the northern Bowen Basin into the network which currently exists south of Gladstone.
And is that the only place that you can connect it to?
No. I mean, effectively, getting it into a pipeline somewhere near Gladstone connects it to Wallumbilla, which is the hub that the Prime Minister is talking about developing and being on a par with Henry Hub. So having a 450-kilometre connection into that network, which then connects to Wallumbilla, is first prize.
Do you think, do you see the government now putting this as a bit of a priority and realising, because at the end of the day, people out there, including myself, you know, one of the challenges are people are looking at where they're spending money. Gas prices have been high, electricity prices have been high, and I know the Prime Minister, it is a focus for him. Will this eventually then start to drive down prices? In other words, I've spoken to people before where I say, you know, Aussies, we need to support our local Australian companies like yourself that are, I guess, not going to be turning around and exporting our gas. You want to deliver to the domestic Australian market, which will in turn drive prices down. Would that be a correct assumption?
Absolutely. We want to develop our gas reserves in the most economic way possible. In other words, we have a low overhead. We're a small company. We're nimble. We don't have the big corporate overheads that some of our competitors do. And so we're quite capable of reducing our cost base to be competitive. And that's, I think, where the Prime Minister's coming from, and indeed NEF Power, is reducing the price to manufacturers so they can make themselves more competitive. Obviously, energy prices are a big component of any manufacturer's cost base. So the point that I'd like to make is we're small, we're nimble, we're low cost. If we can't do it, then no one else can in terms of bringing gas to market. It's a matter of getting the momentum going and getting the gas buyers to engage with us now that they know there is a mechanism that will be put in place to deliver gas to their front door almost.
Now, John, you mentioned that you're small and you're nimble. Oil and gas is a big business, isn't it? I think the Bowen Basin has been controlled by the big guys in the past. Am I correct in saying that?
It went through a genesis of the coal miners originally, like BHP originally had the rights to the gas. They then sold those variously to AGL, funnily enough, and also the original Arrow Energy, which was an ASX listed company before bought out by Shell and PetroChina. So effectively, in the early days, the small Aussie companies managed to make CSG work on the smell of an oily rag. And what's happened, I think, I don't think it could ever have gone to LNG with the size of companies of the Arrows and the Blues of this world. Having said that, Santos developed their CSG fields to do exactly that in consortium with some of the overseas companies. And that vision came from my chairman, who used to run Santos. So,
yes, Mr. Ellis Flint.
That's the man. So his vision of the CSG to LNG process was well founded and turned out to be correct. Just the scale was a bit off. Any of us never thought we'd have three large LNG projects with three sets of infrastructure, three wharves, three plants, three jetties, three pipelines, all of which have cost the taxpayer dearly in terms of being able to deduct those costs against royalties. So effectively, I think it's fair to say that once you get into the mechanism of the international gas player, you become beholden to them into their strategic view of the world and where they need to place their gas. So I'd like to put blue in there as a bit different.
So you'd like, it's like, sorry, this is going to sound so corny. It's kind of like True Blue, John. It's the True Blue.
Happy to take that label.
So really what we're saying is big internationals have come in. There's a big export market. The Bowen Basin has been controlled by the big guys. You're small, you're nimble, you're Australian owned, and you want Blue Energy is ripe to and ready to supply the domestic gas market. You have no intention of exporting internationally. That in turn will help our local manufacturing markets.
We see the opportunity is to bring the domestic businesses along with us and sort of regain a bit of control over our destiny. But I think it's also fair to say and to acknowledge the enormous amount of work and engineering excellence and capital spend that's gone into developing Curtis Island, which if you had told me 20 years ago it was going to happen, I would have just fallen off the chair. I mean, it's been an extraordinary development to get, because you've got to remember, coal seam gas to LNG had never been done before. Hmm. And to then turn around and have three massive plants owned by three different consortium with three sets of infrastructure that go with it is just an extraordinary feat of engineering and capital
waste.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say waste. I guess it came at a bad time in the cycle where the cost base was high because the oil price was high, and that's why you're seeing the write downs now. because the price of the product has gone through the floor. So effectively, I think you've got to doff your hat to the vision of the people who put those plants in and the engineering discipline to get it done.
Well, I want to dive into next steps for Blue Energy from an investor's point of view. As I said right at the start, ASX code is BLU. What can investors hope to or expect from Blue Energy in the near and the longer term?
Well, we have a portfolio of assets. Our near-term asset is the North Bowen Basin, where we have reserves. We're going to market those reserves to gas buyers. So we would hope to be signing gas sales agreements, conditional gas sales agreements or firm gas sales agreements out for some of those reserves and resources going forward. Then following from that will be the infrastructure announcements by government, by private companies wanting to build to meet that demand. The next cab off the rank will be the Galilee Basin, where we have a number of small operators, not dissimilar to Blue, trying to get that concept off the ground and produce gas into the domestic market. So that's the next bolt on. So the Galilee into the Bowen and into the southern market, the eastern market. And then there's the Beetaloo, where Blue has, in close proximity to the main players in the Beetaloo, we have a large acreage position of exploration tenure. We're trying to add value and define a resource there. So we'll become active in the Northern Territory, where our acreage position is about the size of the UK.
Well, Beetaloo, is that, forgive my ignorance, is that in the middle of nowhere?
I think the Territorians would take exception to that.
Apologies, Northern Territory people.
It's around Tennant Creek, either side.
Oh, okay, yep.
So the Northern Territory is sparsely populated. But what you've seen in the example of coal seam gas in Queensland is communities have been reinvigorated by the expenditure of gas companies and the skills training and the ability for the kids to get meaningful employment in the industry has changed the world in some of those areas like Chinchilla, Dalby and Roma. It's drought-proofed a lot of the farms because of the water production.
Let me stop you there, John, because, you know, we all know that there's a deep divide here, isn't there? When you mention coal seam gas, I know people turn around and go, we shouldn't do it. We it's all about renewables, wind, solar, everything else has to go away. And you've mentioned that it's improving lives up there. But what do you say to those people that are out there saying we shouldn't be touching coal seam gas?
Oh, if it's an environmental issue, then you need to look at the studies that have been done globally on fracking. Usually it's around fracking.
Yeah.
But more lately it's become an issue of groundwater disturbance and pollution. What is happening is the coal seam gas industry is drawing off a very small fraction of the water in the coal seams, which is not potable quality. But what they're doing with that water is they're using reverse osmosis, cleaning it up and making it available for beneficial reuse. So landholders are getting irrigation on their properties. They're basically drought-proofing their properties with the supply of water. It's also going into some of the local townships. I mean, Roma's been having its underground water supply topped up with coal seam gas water.
So what you're saying is that when it's locked into the coal seam, it's not drinkable, it's not right for farming, you can't do anything with it, but you guys can come in via reverse osmosis, take that water, make it what they call potable water, which allows the farms to flourish. Perfect. And it can go into also drinking water for those townships, etc. That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, the multiple land use issues around coal seam gas and agriculture in prime agricultural area are complex, but I think they're manageable. And the fact that the industry's managed to negotiate 5,500 compensation agreements and conduct agreements with landowners, I think speaks to the fact that there is an ability to coexist with agriculture. Under the right regulatory environment, it's not there has to be a Goldilocks environment, just the right amount of regulation, otherwise you'll kill the industry. I think it's fair to say that we've been able over the last 10 years to negotiate that tortuous path with landowners. There are some ideologically opposed to us who will always have a problem with what we do. But I think you've got to look at it from a holistic point of view and say the ability to provide hydrocarbons, oil and gas, into a modern first world environment and social structure adds so much value in terms of the products, the services, the utility of those things, in terms of power generation as well, that it's far better off producing than not.
Well, John, I've always said that, you know, Australia lives off mining and agriculture. I mean, that's where we come from. And to hear you say that this is working together is music to my ears.
But the smart money, Kerry, is a value adding to those products we currently import. So there's thousands of products that are manufactured from oil and gas, high-end plastics, 3D printing plastics. We all import them, but that comes from hydrocarbons. If we could add value with a very sophisticated petrochemical industry here, you'd be adding value to the bottom line of the country like you wouldn't believe. Because generally, as usual, what we do is we export it in raw form and import it in manufactured product.
Yeah.
Why do we do that here?
We shouldn't be doing it, and it's a passion of mine. That I was recently interviewing Karen Patterson from Trigg Mining, and you know what she's doing is we don't need to import sulfate of potash. It's the same sort of thing. Let's add the value here on the ground rather than exporting the raw material.
The highest value add for a litre of gas or a kilo of oil is plastics.
Wow. Okay, so John, we're running out of time. Last comments for our listeners out there about what they can expect from Blue Energy. First of all, you're very busy. Your chairman is the former chairman of Santos. What can we expect in the... We've spoken about the fact that there's a lot going on with Bowen. We've talked about the Beetaloo. We've talked about the Galilee. Why is now a great time for investors to take a good look at Blue Energy?
I think the process of evolution of the company is coming to fruition. It's taken a long time, but now that we have some momentum in the North Bowen Basin, where the bulk of our reserves are, we'll be marketing those reserves to people who need gas, which is largely the manufacturers who are squealing for it, and even the retail base, the large retailers of gas who have a customer base they need to keep full. We'll be marketing that gas to all those people who want to gas from an Australian company.
John Phillips, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. I want to talk to you again in the near future because I think there's a lot going on with Blue Energy. Ladies and gentlemen, making sure that we keep everything onshore, the true blue Aussie, Blue Energy. Thanks for chatting to us today, John.
Thanks, Gary. Pleasure.